Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns, over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here talking story every Sunday morning, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Big mahalos to our sponsor, Hawaiian Ukulele at Guitar at Queen's Chops and on Ali'i Drive, right across from Hulahe'e Palace. The podcasts of Island Issues are online at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Just click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. The Waimea Ocean Film Festival in early January 2017 had some truly outstanding films and speakers this year. One film was The Age of Consequences about climate change. Usually when we've talked about climate change, we've talked about the environmental impacts on corals, on sea life, and as some say, we always see segments about how climate change affects polar bears and such. We've also talked about sea level rise, clearly a huge factor for the world, but especially for islands, including ours. But this film, made by Jared Scott, looks at climate change and its impacts on national security, and how climate change is playing a role in some world-altering events going on now, such as the civil war in Syria. To explain more about this, I'm delighted today to have one of the experts featured in the film, retired Navy Rear Admiral David Titley. Aloha, Admiral Titley.
Well, thank you, Sherry, so much for having me here.
Well, just so folks know a little bit about you and your background, Rear Admiral David Titley retired from the Navy in 2012 after 32 years of service. He is now a senior scientist in the Department of Meteorology at Penn State. He's also the founding director of Penn State's Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. Admiral Titley holds a Bachelor of Science in Meteorology from Penn State, and from the Naval Postgraduate School, he earned his Master's in Meteorology and Physical Oceanography and a Ph.D. in Meteorology. While serving as a naval officer for 32 years, David Titley served as commander of the Naval Meteorology and Oceanography Command and was oceanographer and navigator for the Navy. In 2009, he initiated and led the U.S. Navy Task Force on Climate Change, and from 2012 to 2013, he served as the Chief Operating Officer of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Today, he also works as a member of the Military Advisory Board for the consulting organization CNA, a nonprofit research organization that operates the Center for Naval Analyses and the Institute for Public Research. And this Military Advisory Board, according to the CNA website, is an elite group of retired 3- and 4-star flag and general officers from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. And they study pressing issues of the day to assess their impact on America's national security. So the film, The Age of Consequences, I found it to be an eye-opener and really sort of depressing. It was definitely thought-provoking, but it approaches climate change in a very different way, as I mentioned, not so much on environmental issues, but the issues from a military perspective and a national security perspective. So, Admiral Titley, I know you can break down the key conclusions for us. You've talked about climate change affecting our national security in two major ways, and you covered this not only in the film, but in some opinion pieces you've written for newspapers recently, and you've said that you see two major impacts. So tell us a little bit about how climate change affects our national security.
Well, sure. Well, thanks so much, Sherry, for the very kind introduction. Really, there's a whole lot of different aspects to this, which I think the film Age of Consequences shows pretty nicely. But if you only had about 15 or 20 seconds to tell somebody, really, this is about risk management. This is really about looking forward and making sure that our military forces, our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, are going to be able to not only operate, but frankly prevail when called upon by our commander-in-chief. And we need to take into account what I would call, if I was still inside the Pentagon, the physical battle space. Most of us would call it the operating environment. But if you think about it, the armed forces in general, we plan for everything. We plan for changes in governments, changes in economics, changes in demographics. Why wouldn't we plan for a change in, again, that physical operating space, that physical battle space, if we had some reasonable understanding that it would be changing? So when I talk inside the Pentagon, I mean, this is really frankly nothing to do with politics. This is simply making sure that our military is ready for the future. And that's really what this is about.
And that's sort of what the title of the film implies, The Age of Consequences. Whatever is decided has consequences, whether it's a decision to do something or not do something.
Exactly. The consequences will happen. As I've told a number of people, especially since November, the ice doesn't really care who is elected president. It just tends to melt. So we're going to have to deal with, in these coming years, in these coming decades, and again, the way the atmosphere works, irrespective of whatever carbon policy we do or do not have, our climate is going to continue to change for decades. And I'm happy to talk about more about that, why that is. But for right now, we know that's going to change. So really, from a military perspective, almost irregardless of why the climate is changing, if you know it's changing, wouldn't you want to kind of, what I tell my friends in Pennsylvania, shoot ahead of the rabbit? Don't you want to anticipate that so that we make sure that our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines have every possible advantage that we can give them? Because in the United States, we don't want a fair fight. We want to make sure that we're number one.
One of the things you talked about in your opinion pieces was stressors caused by climate change, such as water shortages and crop failures. What's the end result of water shortages and crop failures? And by the way, I'd say this is something we've seen here in the United States, obviously during the Dust Bowl time with devastating effect, but not with the same dramatic consequences since then. But it sure is happening in some other countries in far more significant ways. So tell us why that's important.
Sure. So when we talk about in climate issues, either crop failures, water shortages, really what's happening is we've quite literally built human civilization on this premise, on this implicit premise of climate stability. You can hear people talk about, and they're absolutely right, climate has changed many times before. They're right, but it's changed on hundreds of thousands and millions of years time scale. When you kind of zoom in to when did human civilization start, now we're only talking 8,000, 10,000 years. Relative to those other changes, a very small amount of time. And what we've had is this wonderful climate stability. We knew where the oceans were, so if you built a harbor, you were good. To your point on agriculture, we knew kind of when the rains were going to come. We knew what crops would grow, which would harvest, where you had enough growing days, where the temperatures were not too hot, not too cold, for be it rice, wheat, whatever, corn. And life was good, right? And we've kind of got to where we are now. Now, as the climate starts changing, where we have used to grow and the societies that were so vitally dependent on these, now that's changing. And the real question is going to be, not is it going to change, but how are we as both societies within a country and then internationally going to deal with that? You mentioned some of the droughts, like on the mainland, of course. California's had a bad drought. But we don't have riots in the streets because we have a pretty good safety net and social structure. You go to Syria, which you mentioned in your introduction, there are many, many causes for the human catastrophe that is going on in Syria right now. But one of those causes is a drought that is, even in their long history, nearly unprecedented. And that kind of, without a safety net, with bad governance, with dictatorial type regimes, has taken an already bad situation and pushed it over into one that is catastrophic.
Well, as we record this interview, there was just an article in the Star Advertiser about a big drought in Bolivia. And having just seen the film, The Age of Consequences, and heard you talk, it made me read the article with sort of a different perspective. And it said in that article about Bolivia, all these people who are dependent on farming, who cannot now get the water, now they're migrating. And so where are they going? And that sounds like that's what's happened in some of these countries, such as Syria, where people cannot stay in the professions that they were born into or that they're used to, and they have to go someplace and do something.
Exactly. And what you bring up is, nobody's going to sit on a barren piece of land and slowly starve to death. I mean, you wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. We would take care of ourselves. We would take care of our families. We would kind of do whatever we needed to do to make sure that doesn't happen. So in many cases around the world, what that means is you migrate into a city. Now, how the governments are set up to provide for basic needs, to assimilate? Is there jobs? Is there food? Is there basic sanitation, drinking water? If there is, it's probably not going to be a great situation, but it's probably manageable. If there isn't, then you go from desperation to absolutely you will grasp at any straw. And if you have some extremist movement come in and says, Sherry, I will take care of your family if you sign up for me, and you are starving and you are dying of thirst, you may take them up on that offer, even if you'd said maybe 3 years ago, there's no way I would join such an organization. People, when they are put into these desperate circumstances, will do desperate things. So the root cause of this goes back into the climate, but then how we respond is really one of a social, a civil, a governmental type response.
Well, interestingly, a lot of the governments that are not the United States government, for in Syria, for example, clearly they have not been able to adequately respond, which is why you have suddenly huge migration, people fleeing and even fleeing the country because there's nothing for them in their home country. And these are people who might be people who are farmers, but also people who might be professional people who suddenly the system is no longer working for them.
Exactly. I mean, and these are sort of these follow-on consequences to these climate changes that aren't always captured. As you mentioned at the beginning of the introduction, you know, when most people say climate change, and if you say, you know, point at you and say, quick, what's the first thing in your mind? Not everybody, but many people say, oh, it's that lonely, scrawny, thin polar bear on that kind of unstable little piece of ice floating into a blue Arctic. And that's certainly an issue. And I don't mean to downplay or denigrate in any way the environmental aspects. They're very, very significant. But when I talk about this outside the film, I actually give a talk, and it's called People Not Polar Bears. And the reason for that is, as bad as I feel for the polar bears, this is going to affect all of us. And how we respond to that is really going to be key. But we have already seen, as you mentioned, the migration, the loss of life in the Mediterranean, some of the issues in Africa, some of the potential issues in Africa over water, like between Ethiopia and Egypt, is starting to look not pretty good. And all of these are going to kind of blow up. And, you know, when you talk to people like The Economist, they don't always look at these types of things, these follow-on consequences. And, you know, if we were looking at a cost of sort of our climate change, my opinion is you need to roll in these human costs as well as the economic costs.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues, and I'm Sherry Bracken. We're here on the radio on Hawaii Island every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And then we post the interviews online, so you may listen to them anytime. Lava1053.com or KoaCountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. Today my guest is retired Navy Rear Admiral David Titley. He was here on the island in early January for the Waimea Ocean Film Festival, which, by the way, comes up at the beginning of January each year, and I recommend it for its thought-provoking films and speakers. It's really excellent. Until he retired in 2012, Admiral David Titley was a climatologist and meteorologist for the Navy and prepared documentation for them and still does consulting work in the area of climate change and how it affects national security, and that's what we're talking about. He'll be my guest next week as well when we get more into some of the political aspects and what needs to be done to make changes. We talk about the challenges to the Navy. We talk about the National Intelligence Council report on climate change and congressional funding. Let's get back to my conversation with retired Rear Admiral David Titley. We've talked about drought, but clearly climate change, as pointed out in the film, is a lot tied into water, whether it's the lack of water in drought or excessive water, as in more frequent storms, worse storms, hurricanes, typhoons. And we've seen that in our own country with Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy. But in other countries, when this happens, it seems like the U.S. military, of which you have most recently been a part, is called on. And they're called on in the case of war. They're called on in the case of disaster to help and support. Why is that a role that the United States should play on the world stage?
There's a lot of parts to that question. Let me first sort of start with the water. So when I am asked to describe, you know, climate change, I try to put it into three words, because if you talk for 5 hours, nobody really remembers what you said anyways. So I talk about people, water, and change. We've already talked about people. And when I talk about water, it's really too much, too little, wrong place, wrong time, salty where it used to be fresh, wet where it used to be dry. Even the very chemistry of the oceans are changing. And water is actually a pretty good integrating principle for some of these changes that we're having. So you're absolutely right that these many, many aspects of water are changing. Whether storms are in fact getting stronger or not is still somewhat debated. The hurricanes and typhoons, probably you're starting to see a few more strong ones. But what you certainly are seeing is when the storm surges come, they're coming on ever higher baselines. We know that. We have very, very high confidence in that. So even I tell my friends, okay, maybe you don't think the storms are going to get stronger, fine. But those storm surges, be it in Hawaii or on the mainland or in Asia, in Japan, in the Philippines, are all coming in on a higher baseline, and they're going to do more and more damage. So to your point now about why should the United States, why should the U.S. military in particular respond? Very simply, we have the capability that very few, and I would argue in many instances, no other military has to do this. I could argue this is a moral or humanitarian issue. If I was a policy realist, I would also say that this is a tremendous demonstration of United States, what we would call soft power. Soft power does not mean killing people and breaking things. It means making other people's lives better. When we look at the tsunami response, the Boxing Day tsunami response in 2003, I think it was, in Indonesia. Now, tsunamis, I'm sure all of your listeners totally understand tsunamis are not related to climate change, but it was a massive natural disaster, over hundreds of thousands of people killed. The United States responded. China either did not or could not respond. The response probably bought us more goodwill in Southeast Asia and South Asia than a dozen aircraft carrier battle groups. And I say that as a naval officer. So I think it's in the United States' interest as well as simply as a moral issue. The United States military is really, really good actually at doing humanitarian assistance and disaster relief compared to high-end warfighting. Nobody's shooting at you. It's chaos. They just want help. They want water. They want help. We can deliver that through helicopters. We have intelligence. We have communications. We can set up an organization and then turn it over to, let's say, a non-governmental type organizations like the Red Cross or similar type non-governmental organizations. The issue becomes, from a climate change, is if you start doing this more and more and more, it becomes what I call a capacity issue. You know, how much then of your military is doing this, which is a great mission to do, but you also want to make sure in a military, in anyone's military, and certainly in the United States, that we are more than able to not only successfully defend, but frankly win a high-end war. We hope we never have to fight one again, but one of the ways you make sure of that is by demonstrating to everybody else that you will come in second if you try to mess with us. So you spend a lot of time making sure that you are in fact ready to do that. If you are spending more and more and more time on humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, that means you have less time on the high-end warfighting. One other component becomes simply another type of capacity. If you are cutting, which we have cut quite substantially, the size of the United States Army, to a lesser extent the Marine Corps, but mostly we've cut the size of the Army, the fancy term in the Pentagon, we would call it risk mitigation. What does that mean? Plan B. Okay, Plan B is like, okay, we have the National Guard, we have the reserve. Well, the National Guard, as I'm sure everybody knows, actually works for the governors. And if the governors are using the National Guard to respond to disasters within the United States, within their state, those troops are not available to, let's say, go overseas to do other parts of the nation's business. So there is, in fact, some risk of doing more and more humanitarian assistance missions, although we're good at it. But there is a risk because we're going to eventually run out of capacity.
Well, the military gets involved in such assistance here in the country a lot, and I look at things such as Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, and I was sort of musing about that. At what point does our military, whether it's National Guard or other military that's called in to help, run out of capacity to help even in the U.S.? I'm not sure we did a great job with Hurricane Katrina based on everything I saw. And maybe that was lack of judgment, but if we had two Hurricane Katrinas at the same time, it's not clear to me that our country could handle it.
If you remember, so Katrina was August 29th of 2005. I know that because I had a house that was about 5 miles away from landfall. Had is the operative word. And at that time, we were also conducting the surge in Iraq. So it may not have made a lot of the general media, but there was real concern in the Pentagon of trying to do, it's to your point exactly, of trying to do both these missions at the same time, because it was much more than the National Guard of Mississippi and Louisiana that responded. It was really tens of thousands of active duty troops from all services, including the Coast Guard. Coast Guard had a huge response, while at the same time we're fighting a major war in Iraq. And we came very close to basically running out of capacity. So that's kind of a glimpse into the future right there.
Well, when you talk about capacity, you're a Navy man, and we haven't really talked about this, but the Navy itself is going to have to address climate change issues. The Navy has military bases that are on the water. I mean, one of our biggest naval bases for ship repair is in Norfolk, Virginia, is it not? And I look at Pearl Harbor here. I don't know how much danger Pearl Harbor's in, but talk about what has to be done to make sure our military bases are not inundated as the sea level does rise, which, as you said, it clearly is.
And this is really one of these creeping issues that whether the politicians like it or not, they're going to have to address. So I, when I was on active duty running the Navy's Task Force on Climate Change, you know, I would tell people that, yeah, we are going to have to deal with the sea level rise. And for the Navy especially, it's kind of a ship thing. We tend to put our bases at sea level. You know, we're not like the Air Force. We can't just move to Minot, North Dakota at 5,000 feet and be done with it. We're not going to do that. So we are going to deal with this. And then the question becomes, the Navy then looks to the science community and says, okay, if the seas are coming up, about how fast are they going to come up? Is this a issue that I got to deal with this decade, in the next 30 years, the next century? How fast? So when I was first asked these questions by the head of the Navy 6 years ago now, 7 years ago, I told my boss that basically prepare for a little over 3 feet, 1 meter. So a little over 3 feet. But I said, but if I'm wrong, I'm probably wrong on the low side. And back then, the sort of the science consensus, frankly, was about 12 inches. And this is until the year 2100. And they thought I was kind of crazy. But I was looking at the data of how much ice was coming off of like the Greenland ice sheet and indications of the Antarctic ice sheet. Fast forward now 7 years almost. And I would say now 1 meter or just a little over 3 feet is now very mainstream in thinking. And there are more and more sort of respected scientists who are starting to think about the possibility of somewhere between 1 and 2 meters of sea level rise between now and the year 2100. Now, for all of your listeners who are of a certain age, like I am, you might remember Tip O'Neill, famous former Speaker of the House, and he, of course, famously said that all politics is local. And it turns out that sea level rise is local, too. So you need to understand, it turns out when you start melting enough of the ice, the gravity field changes, so you got to account for that. There are places, especially on the mainland and even more so up in Alaska, where the land itself is still rebounding from the ice age. So you have places like Norfolk that are sinking and places like Alaska that are rising. And then you can change some of the big ocean currents like the Gulf Stream, like the Kuroshio Current off of Japan. And depending on whether that current is speeding up or slowing down, you get these local sea level rise changes as well. So you got to put all of that together. But the big picture is, if we don't get the carbon emissions under control, if we sort of keep doing what we're doing, most of Greenland will melt. That is about 6 to 7 meters of sea level rise. So in old money terms, that's 20 to 22, 23 feet. That's a lot. Now, it's not all going to happen this decade. It's not all going to happen this century. But we're starting to, if we don't cap the carbon emissions, we start locking in those kinds of numbers. So even 2 degrees Celsius, you know, that's what, a little under 4 degrees Fahrenheit from the pre-industrial baseline, that's probably the long-term stabilization is going to be order 15, 15 feet of sea level rise. And for anybody who's, I mean, we're staying in a very, very nice place down in Kohala Coast.
At the Fairmont.
It's a wonderful, wonderful resort, just as many of the resorts on the Kona Coast here are on the Big Island. You can go to Waikiki. You can go to so many places. And if you walk around there and think of what does this look like with 10, 15 feet of sea level rise, it's not a pretty answer. And everybody in the country, I think, will eventually come to this realization. If you had asked me, it was like, what is going to change people's minds and sort of get us off top dead center? I think it will be the growing realization of sea level rise. You're starting to see this in Florida. You're starting to see many conservative Republicans starting to get very concerned. Now, maybe not the governor of Florida, but several of the congressmen who just got reelected, really quite conservative, are talking quite sensibly because they see it as a local issue and their constituents are concerned. And if they're, I always tell people in the Navy, like, if you're my boss and you're interested, then I am fascinated. Well, the constituents are getting very, very interested, and that will get the Congress fascinated. But it's at what time? And the sad thing is, from a science, or tragic, I guess not sad, but tragic thing from the science perspective, is that sea level rise is the ultimate, what we would call a lagging indicator. By the time the seas have come up, that meant the ice is already melted, and it's really hard to sort of put Humpty Dumpty back together again there.
A little too late to address it.
So we're you know, in the Navy, I would call it steering by our wake. You know, if you're on land, it's like steering in your rearview mirror. And it's like, oh, that was really bad. It's like, yes, it was, and you probably should have addressed it 10 or 15 years ago, or 20.
You know, when you look at sea level rise, clearly the coastal states from Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, all the way around, and certainly the state of Hawaii, I think that we probably see and feel the concern more. I look at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Chip Fletcher and his team have been redoing the tsunami sea level rise maps just based on sea level rise and what could happen in the future. And so that's the coastal states, but then you have the other states, and you have also the issue of this has become so partisan. You know, I look back at Republican George H.W. Bush, the first Bush. He addressed climate change early on. He said he was going to do something about it. He called himself the environmental president. But now it's become very polarized. Well, it seems like a lot of Republicans object to, don't believe, deny, question whether there is even climate change, whereas Democrats seem more amenable to the concept that the science is correct. So what has happened to make it be that way?
It is a fascinating question. And I would recommend to your listeners a book written by Naomi Oreskes called Merchants of Doubt. It's not the whole answer, but I think it does show how there has, in fact, been a concerted effort, very frankly, to instill doubt into the whole climate change question.
A concerted effort by whom?
Actually, it was the same people who ran the campaign to convince people that smoking is good for you, or at least not harmful. That there is nothing wrong with acid rain, nothing wrong with DDT. And really what it is, it's these issues are sort of one of issues, but it really gets into a philosophy of, I don't want the government telling me in any way, shape, or form how I should live my life or how I should be regulated. And when I talk to most of the so-called climate deniers, it fairly quickly becomes they don't know about the science and they don't really care about the science. But they do believe that the policies would require additional regulation of their lives, to which they are vehemently opposed. So I think it's become really this policy divide between those who sort of, I would say, are looking at things for a communal good, and that we all realize we need to make some sacrifices for the community, and others who are a bit very individualistic. And it's like, hey, I'm going to live my life, I'm free, and it's going to stay that way, and that's, you know, end of discussion. If people look at work done by a guy named Dan Kahan out at Yale, he's a lawyer, but he's actually done some pretty interesting psychology work. Tribal identities really, really count. So like if all of your friends really are in this very individualistic belief and Sherry says, you know, hey, there may be something to this, you might lose all your friends. And I don't know how you would personally respond, but there have been quite a few studies done that most people would prefer to keep their friends and keep their social networks rather than sort of being that person who raises that very uncomfortable and very unpopular issue. So we sort of bond to these tribal sort of, and I use that word because in some sense we're all kind of tribal, whether we're left of center or right of center or libertarian or whatever, but that kind of, we have that self-identification. And of course, social media and its, you know, 9 million channels, and it's so much easier to now come up on your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed with only things that make you feel good. And it's like, well, of course they're right and all those other people are not. So it seems like all of this feeds in. I think Al Gore meant tremendously well, but when he so closely associated himself with this, there were so many Republicans that said, if Al Gore's for it, I'm against it. And ever since then, we've seen the increasing partisan divide. Nowadays, we almost think of the 1990s as the good old days when people could get things done. So I think there have been a number of these issues, and it's going to be very interesting to see how some of the Republicans, how some of the conservatives can kind of get themselves off this creaking tree branch and get back on. And I hope my left of center friends don't use this to try to like drive a stake through their heart, because when somebody kind of like does the finger in the chest and says you're a flat earther and you're stupid, does that really change people's minds?
And with that, we're going to take a pause in our conversation with retired Navy Rear Admiral David Titley, who is here in early January for the Waimea Ocean Film Festival as one of the very excellent speakers. We'll pick up the conversation next Sunday morning. And meanwhile, if you'd like to listen to this or any other island issues, you may do so online, lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. And until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.